Well, I thank you very much. Because surely, as I always say, I can do very little without the Spirit of God to help me. And I realize that this subject that I had read this or read this morning in the announcements may have been a little presumptuous and almost, well, maybe I better just leave it at that, a little bit presumptuous, because by no means can I cover this subject in a short sermon. And I don't wish to, you know, make this a long sermon. But I was rather confident when I started on this, and I just started on it just last few days. I was confident that, in a sense, and yet I was confused, and I had to pray pretty strongly to unravel my confusion so that I would have some sense, and I hope and pray that I don't pass on any confusion onto anybody else. First of all, I would like to give a little bit of a testimony. I think each one of you that have been converted to this gospel from another church, you have had more than just an understanding of what the structure of the church should be to convert you to this church. If you understand what I mean. It wasn't that you saw 12 apostles in the church that made you say, well, this is the true church of Christ. You went to the Lord and said, is this the true church of Christ? And as a result, you were given an answer. And each one of you probably have a testimony. Well, I have a testimony that's rather peculiar. I was raised by parents who had joined this church when I was just a mere infant. And I was raised to believe in it. I was never a member of any other Restoration church. In fact, I wasn't baptized until I was in my late 20s. But I went through an experience that I've given in testimony, I'm sure most of you, if not all of you, have heard. But I contested the validity of this church, just right down almost to the wire. And I know the only thing that brought me into this church was the prayers of my parents. And don't ever underestimate your prayers if you are a parent. Or don't ever underestimate the prayers of your parents, because they have a special end with God, if I can put it that way. But so I asked to know if this was come down to that point. I asked to know of the Lord, is this the true church of Christ? I'd been taught to believe in it, and I just couldn't believe that it just happened by that I just happened to be born into the church or into a family who believed in this church. And so I asked, and I received my answer. I went to church, and I bawled like a baby, if you want to call it that, but the Spirit was all over me. I went to the temple lot one time, and it happened, and I came out here to the East Local when there's a meeting in the garage, and it happened there. The Lord didn't care if he embarrassed me a little bit. He let me know what I wanted to know. So I never put much stock in proving that this church was set up correctly and that what our forefathers did to prove or to establish the church in the correct way or make correction. I never had much interest in it. And I was rather provoked that in this late date that there would be a certain challenge to us to try to prove why we believe thus and so. And as you know, I received some correspondence in this respect, and it was here and there a little bit, and Well, I was put on the spot. Do you know or do you not know? Well, I couldn't just keep telling my testimony. I had to show them something. Why did the church believe this? And I said, well, just get the outline history. And still, they challenged that and twisted it all up and so forth. Well, so I had to get busy and find out. And I realized at the same time that I might, you know, just put it off, put off the whole thing. But I realized that it might affect some of the members of this local church. So I said, well, I'd better find out what it's all about. I go to the Articles of Faith and Practice, something that gives us a kind of a statement by which we can determine what this church believes. And Article 13 says, we believe in the same church organization as existed in the time of Christ and his apostles. The highest office in the church is that of an apostle, of whom there are 12, who constitute special witnesses for Jesus Christ. They have the missionary supervision and the general watch care of all the churches. It does not say that we do not believe in the First Presidency. It doesn't have to say that. It just says that the 12, the apostles, were of the highest office in the church, which is the same as what Christ had in his day, what he set up. Well, the thing that we have to look at, and this is the discouraging thing, because I know through my own experience that the more I looked at it, the more disturbed and discouraged I became. So there is an element here that might have an effect upon you, as it did upon me. And I know it has had an effect upon others. Because when you suddenly realize that back in Joseph Smith's time, that there was something set up in the church that was wrong, that was definitely wrong, an office in the church that was definitely wrong, then you say, well, where do we get, how can we make correction in that? That goes clear back to the beginning days of the church. I don't say beginning days, but the beginning years, I mean to say. Well, I have numbered here four things that you might say look wrong about the Church of Christ to the Restoration peoples. When they look at us and compare us to their churches, they say, well, this is wrong, and this is wrong, and this is wrong. And these things are points that I feel that are rather glaring. But we have to defend them if we remain organized as we are. First place, we are a minority. Of all the other original divisions of the churches of the Restoration, other original divisions, I'm talking about the divisions back just after Joseph Smith was martyred, that when the churches were then set up, those original divisions, as far as I know, this is the only one who does not have a First Presidency at the head of the church. Now, I can be wrong on that because I'm not, but this is the one, as far as I know. So we are a minority. We're not only a minority in that fact, but we're a minority as far as numbers are concerned. The other churches, there's two larger churches that outnumber us considerably. So we're just kind of a very small segment or remnant of the original church that does not have a presidency over the church. As I said before, number two, the original church, while Joseph Smith was still living, had set up a presidency over the church. Number three, Latter-day Revelation as contained in the Doctrine and Covenants, which is accepted by, I think, all of the other groups, of the original groups, provides for a presidency. And these, what I'm talking about, came during Joseph Smith's time, these revelations. The Church of Christ, called the Hebrewites, is the name of one, had a president over the church at one time. Now here again, it sounds like we're being inconsistent. Granville Hedrick was ordained to the office of first presidency of the church to preside over the high priesthood and to be a prophet, seer, revelator, and translator of the Church of Christ. Now, if you want to make reference to this, this is an outline history, page 102. And there was no change. As far as we can find in history, there was no change other than the fact that I think Granville Hedrick passed on. But that office, or the belief, as far as we can see, was retained until 1925. Now again, I can be incorrect. There's no way of really going into this in detail. I depend a great deal on the outline history. In 1925, on October 8th, a resolution was adopted which abolished the office of presiding elder. Now you might say, well, that's not a president. But actually, in the revelation given, the first revelation that was given, which was an insertion in the one of the revelations, does refer to it as the president as a presiding elder. They're synonymous. So in 1925, the Church of Christ abolished that office. This was found on page 102. Wait a minute. No, page 139 in the outline history. It's when they abolished this office. Now, there was another resolution that was on this same page that was given or made by the church. It says that we petition the Lord for direction as to the choosing of the apostles, and such other matters as he may see fit to impart unto us. This is taken from the old record. So when they abolished the presiding elder, they went of the office of presiding elder, they immediately made a resolution to choose out the apostles. And from that time on, for several years, they were in the process of filling the Council of 12 apostles in the Church of Christ. Now, I think it was 2 days before this was given, and it's again on the same page of the outline history, there was a resolution. One of the first resolution, perhaps the first resolution of this nature that was given. This was on October 6, 1925. It says, resolved that this Church of Christ accept nothing purporting to be a revelation from God, past, present, or future, as a revelation from God, save that which is in harmony with both the Bible and the Book of Mormon. Be it further resolved that if there be any ruling, understanding, or resolution conflicting therewith, that it be hereby rescinded. As I know, that was the first time that they established the need of all revelations being consistent with the Bible and the Book of Mormon. And I know that this resolution has possibly been changed. In fact, this recent years we have made a resolution similar to this. But this was the turning point in the Church of Christ where you might say we have records to show what the Church of Christ stood for. Now we wonder about this. I don't know that there's anybody here that was in the church back in 1925. Today we have as a heritage these things before us. And they're important records to us, and they're important in the fact that we know the reason of them. Now, as I go into this, I can find these particular inconsistencies that existed from Joseph Smith's time down through these years. The fallacy of having set up a first presidency. And I'll tell you very honestly, when I look at these things, it's very disheartening to me. And it's one of the most displeasing things that I can do because I'm an idealist by nature. That's the reason why I really don't delve into this too much. And I guess I'm oversensitive. But I have seen it, as I said before, I've seen it take people who begin to doubt, they don't know where to stop. And people that have had great potential, young men who have held a priesthood, who have had great potential, have turned away and departed from the church because they just didn't know when to stop doubting. Once you find that in your original church and the things that you held to, the very fact that Joseph Smith was a prophet and then to have fallen below that level and set up things that were contrary to the will of God and contrary to God's established word, it is one of the most disheartening things that I can describe. And yet we have to face it. There's not one of us can say, well, it didn't happen. Or I'm going to pretend it never happened. It did happen. Man does have weakness that permits that to happen. Now, the outline history tells us something that's very important, and this was an observance, I believe, that Granddad Flint made, and that was if there hadn't been this office established in the original church, that when Joseph Smith was martyred, the church would not have necessarily split all into different factions. It was an office of prestige that set a man above everybody else. One man. Well, naturally, there was a great clamor for different ones to get this position. They, each one, said, well, I will be the president. I'm supposed to be the president. And so you find that Brigham Young took the majority of them out west with him. And he immediately went into apostasy, picking up some of the things, some of the seeds of apostasy even before he left. The various teachings of polygamy and the Adam God teachings and, well, you name it, there was a number of things there. But these things are brought out. If it hadn't happened, then the church would not have split up, according to the observance that Brother Flint made, which I believe is true. But this goes to prove a point. And it's something that we got to go back and look at, and look closely at, and consider in, you might say, in our very soul, our very spirit. Because we know that the devil realized that this was the true church being restored here on earth. So what was he doing? He attacked it in every way that he possibly could. And he attacked the one person that would have the most effect upon the total church, Joseph Smith. And of course he found weakness there, which in truth we would all, I dare say, be subject to fail in a situation like that. And of course this sounds like I'm passing judgment upon him, but we have to consider, as I said, that if each one of us are put in that position, what might happen to us. So he inserted within the church the things that were false. He brought them in, the devil brought them into the church. And as a result, we find this great apostasy. Immediately, the big percentage of them going west went into apostasy as they rebaptized their membership even before they got out to Utah. But even so, later on, other churches, having a false head for over the church, would eventually go into apostasy, which we find today, you might say, in the final throes of apostasy, even right in our own community. We see this. So, the Lord, having his own wisdom and purpose, chose a remnant out of all this that he might be able to use. An insignificant group of people, kind of remote from the others, and he led them back here to Independence, and little by little worked with them until they were able to see the fallacy of the original church. Well, we should consider, as I said, these things are kind of hard to look at, but we should consider that that there was a change made. I want to turn to the Book of Commandments, chapter 4, and read the 5th verse. And if any of you have studied this and made some comparisons with the Doctrine and Covenants, you'll find immediately that I am reading a paragraph that was omitted, and I believe deliberately omitted, from the Doctrine and Covenants, the same revelation that's given in the Doctrine and Covenants. And thus, if the people of this generation harden not their hearts, I will work a reformation among them, and will put down all lyings and deceivings and priestcrafts and envyings and strifes and adulteries and sorceries and all manner of iniquities, and I will establish my church like unto the church which was taught by my disciples in the days of old. Now this is what our forefathers, if you want to call them Hedrickites, proceeded to do. They went back and tried to establish this church as in the days of old, to make corrections as was necessary. Another peculiarity found in the Book of Commandments. Now, I think we all know what happened here with the Book of Commandments. It was given, or it was bound as a book in 1833, I believe it was. Find my notes here. And the Doctrine and Covenants, the first edition of the Doctrine and Covenants, was bound as a book in 1835. Now we say that, of course, many of these revelations were given prior to the time that these that this book was, these books were bound as a book. Now there was this revelation in the 15th chapter of the Book of Commandments was given in June 1829, and it was given to Joseph and Oliver and David. And a particular statement here in the 10th and 11th verses, this is on page 27. And now, Oliver, I speak unto you and also unto David by way of commandment. For behold, I command all men everywhere to repent, and I speak unto you even as unto Paul, mine apostle, for you are called even with the same calling with which he was called. Now this is either verbatim or only minor changes, I think, in the Doctrine and Covenants. But over here in the 27th verse, the next page, there's something significantly different. And now behold, there are others which are called to declare my gospel, both unto the Gentile and unto the Jew, yea, even unto 12. That means no more than 12 apostles were to be chosen out. In the Doctrine and Covenants, the word unto is omitted. Sounds like I'm making a case here, but I hope you understand these are things that are significant facts of history. Now, what about this? They said that they were, these two brethren, Oliver and David, were to choose out the 12. That sounds pretty, well, I mean, it's quite a responsibility. But if you were given such a commandment as that, what would you do about it? Would you go to Joseph and say, well, I don't know whether I should do this or not. Or just kind of hesitate. Well, 3 years later, let's see, this was given, that's about 5 years later, they finally got around doing it. 5.5 years, I think it was, before they selected out 12 apostles. I think they were a little slow about it because something happened in between. And on January 25, 1832, in Amherst, Ohio, Joseph Smith was ordained president of the high priesthood. And that's not even hardly recorded as a matter of history. It's just kind of stuck in there and just kind of hardly no significance to it at all. And if you read the outline of history, you'll find some comments about it that Brother Flint makes here. I don't know if it's necessary to go into it. But in the Joseph Smith's own account of this, on the 26th of April, 1832, which was 4 months later, he says, I called, on the 26th of April, I called a general council of the church in Missouri and was acknowledged as the president of the high priesthood according to a previous ordination at the Conference of High Priests, Elders, and Members held at Amherst, Ohio on the 25th of January, 1832. Well, the church historian, the RLDS church historian, many years later, kind of doctored it up a little bit. He explained that the provision for this office was given in the Doctrine and Covenants section 17, verse 17. Actually, 16 and 17. I want to read those to you because this is where this was established. And by no means is this a commandment saying you will ordain or you will set aside certain individuals as in the high priesthood or the presidents of the church. It doesn't really state that. It's just kind of an offhand remark. Maybe I shouldn't put it that way, but just it's pointing at something else and saying that the this and so will do such and such. The 16th verse says, no person is to be ordained in any office to in this church where there is a regularly organized branch of the same without the vote of that church. But the presiding elders, traveling bishops, high counselors, high priests, and elders may have the privilege of ordaining where there is no branch of the church, that a vote may be called. Every president of the high priesthood or presiding elder. This is where we get, you can use that word interchangeably, that term interchangeably. Bishop, high counselor, and high priest is to be ordained by the direction of the high council or general conference. Now the peculiarity of this, again if you've been a student of these things, is that when you go over here in the 24th chapter of the Book of Commandments, and on page 41, you will find verse 44, and you will find verse 45. Between those two verses of this same revelation, which was printed later in the Doctrine and Covenants, that there was no mention of this in there. Those two verses were completely left out, or were not in other words, they did not exist until they reprinted this revelation in the Doctrine and Covenants, which was in 1835. In the Book of Commandments, these two, or in the Doctrine and Covenants, these two verses were inserted. In that revelation at all. And he kind of covered it up by saying that those, well, I take that back. In the Utah church history, they made it a little bit better. They said, well, there were certain things that were left out of the original revelation that they had to rewrite and make some changes and so forth to in accordance with the present officers. Well, I think they were a little more honest about it. It was just that the office came into existence after the fact of the revelation. The revelation didn't provide for it. The office provided for the revelation, if you want to put it or turn it around. So these things are so discouraging and so confusing. If you bear with me, I'm just trying to show you what might really shake your faith. Actually, the provision for a president of the high priesthood, the actual provision came in 1835 in section 104 of the Doctrine and Covenants. And there it makes it real plain that what those offices are. I say high priesthood, I say the president of the high priesthood or the first presidency. And I'd like to distinguish on that. The terminology here is real important. and I hope that if I don't say anything else, I clarify that there indeed is a high priesthood. As compared to the other priesthood. There is the Melchizedek priesthood, which is the highest form of priesthood, or highest, what is the right word to say? Well, I'll say the highest level of priesthood that exists. And that is the Melchizedek priesthood. Then, of course, there is the lesser priesthood. It's not the lower priesthood, but it's the lesser priesthood that is that also exists, and these are both after the order of the Son of God. We don't want to forget that. Jesus Christ has is the founder, or you might say the originator, of these priesthood. And there are scriptures that I don't know as I can get to them. Like I said, this is such a big subject. But there are scriptures that bear these things out. That Melchizedek himself, according to the Book of Mormon, was of the higher priesthood. He was considered a high priest. And so we want to look at it from that standpoint, and he is the one from whom this priesthood is named. I wanted to point out, as we've already pointed out, that the Bible and the Book of Mormon are standard scriptures. And there's something here that's pretty important. Why do we believe that the Bible and the Book of Mormon are our standard scriptures? Well, of course, there's things within those scriptures themselves that indicate that they are. But Latter-day Revelation tells us that. And this is one that recently someone likes to pull a little trick on me, has tried to confuse me on it. Chapter 44. I'm sorry, I'm so slow in this. Page 72 in the Book of Commandments is a verse that tells us very plainly this. And again, the elders, priests, and teachers of this church shall teach the scriptures which are in the Bible and the Book of Mormon, in the which is the fullness of the gospel. I like to stop there because there is a semicolon, meaning and, or you go on from there. But that is a statement in itself, because the Bible and the Book of Mormon is the fullness of the gospel. There is contained the fullness of the gospel, and that's what our Articles of Faith says. It does not say the Bible, the Book of Mormon, and the Book of Commandments. It does not say the Bible, the Book of Mormon, and the Doctrine and Covenants. It says the Bible and the Book of Mormon, and this is coming right from our Latter-day Revelation itself. But it goes on. And they shall observe the covenants and church articles to do them, and these are they to be their teachings. Well, immediately, I get this stuck right up in my face, the Doctrine and Covenants. It says, well, the covenants are right there. They shall observe the covenants. Well, in a recent sermon, I don't believe it was here, someplace else, I did a research prior to this sermon on covenants. If you want a covenant, if you want to know about the covenants, just look up in your concordance in the Bible and the Book of Mormon, and you will find from page 1 clear through to the end in both the Bible and the Book of Mormon much, much, much about God's covenants with man. The promises that he has made with man, and the promises that man has to make with God. They're twofold, and they're very important, because everything hinges upon man's reaction to God. He made a promise to Abraham that carries clear down to our day and beyond us. That was a covenant, and it's called a covenant. And yet, that covenant is only in effect by the response or the reaction of man, of whatever people it is. It includes not only the house of Israel, who are of the seed of Abraham. It not only includes the seed of Abraham, but it includes the Gentiles, because it is all people that are affected in any way by the gospel of Christ this covenant reaches to. So, yes, we are to observe the covenants. There's no question about it. And if you have any question about whether it is this book, consider, as I said before, that the or this book, either one, that this, when this revelation was given in February 1831, this book did not exist as a book. Neither, most certainly, this book did not exist. This was published in 1833 and this one 1835. So we're not, and many of the revelations that are contained in both these books were given after 1831. So let us not be confused. Like I said, these things are little tricky things that get handed to us that we just have to stop and think about a little bit. Well, I'd like for us to consider what a president is. It's not a bad word. We have a president over this country. He's one who presides. In fact, he presides over a body of people. The term is presiding elder. As your pastor, I preside over this body of people, as occasion warrants and services and so forth. And the presidency, if you would rather use that word than president, is the office of president. There is a man that is presently a president of the church. I get my words all tangled up here. Ronald Reagan is presently the President of the United States. But the office he holds is the presidency, which existed long before he became president. So that's one way to look at it. Well, now, what do we find in the scriptures about a president? We think, well, that's more or less a modern term, and it is. You don't find president or presidency in the scriptures. But you do find that I did find one word, the word preside. In the Book of Mormon, on page 321, the first verse that's the fourth chapter of Alma, it tells that Alma ordained priests and elders by laying on of his hands according to the order of God, to preside and watch over the church. It doesn't say anything about an office, a presiding elder as such. They weren't, although yes, they were, priests and elders. But there was two orders of the priesthood there, as near as we can tell, the Melchizedek and the Aaronic priesthood. But they were to preside and watch over the church, much like a pastor does. Well, we go on then, and let's find out what the high priests are. This is the most confusing subject of all, and I don't know whether I can even get close to explaining what I have found, and you may not agree with me when I explain it. One of the things that influenced me, I found I was one of those fortunate individuals who was given a bunch of copies of church publications. This is The Torch of Truth, printed by James E. Yates in Phoenix, Arizona, and this was July 1928. He has an article here. I say that he, I don't know who it is. It don't have a name on it. So I suppose it's his writing. But I want to read the first paragraph, and it gives you kind of an idea of what I'm talking about. On the question of high priests, none of our people should forget that the Melchizedek priesthood is the highest priesthood conferred upon men in any age of time. Also that ordination to the office, or service of high priest has therefore never been more than a call or appointment to a certain division of ministerial service within the authority of the one and only specific high priesthood there is, namely, the Melchizedek priesthood. That's kind of a tricky sentence. I don't know how else to read it. When one receives the Melchizedek priesthood, he is then in very reality a high priest, because there is no higher priesthood. An apostle is an elder, and the only office. Let me get this correct. All members of the Melchizedek priesthood are elders, as far as we can comprehend. Now, some may be set aside as a special division of that as apostles. In our church, we have bishops which have certain duties. But it is questionable as to whether or not they have to be of the Melchizedek priesthood. Now, my comprehension is simply this, that there is a high priesthood, the Melchizedek priesthood. There is a lesser priesthood, the Aaronic priesthood. And they come from, as the scriptures tell us, maybe I should read it if I can find it quickly. I'm going to have to cut this short. In the Book of Mormon, page 348. Starting with verse 63, it says, I would that ye should remember the Lord God ordained priests after his holy order, which was after the order of his Son, to teach these things unto the people. And these priests were ordained after the order of his Son in a manner that thereby the people might know in what manner to look forward to his Son for redemption. I'm going to skip some of this and go over here to try to break in here. Now, if you would, go back and reread this through, from the 63rd verse on through verse 15 in the 10th chapter, because it all pertains to this. But to get some sense here, I'll start with the 68th verse. Or in fine, in the first place, they were on the same standing with their brethren, thus this holy calling being prepared from the foundation of the world for such as would not harden their hearts, being in and through the atonement of the only begotten Son who was prepared, and thus being called by his holy calling and ordained unto the high priesthood of the holy order of God, to teach his commandments unto the children of men, that they also might enter into his rest. This high priesthood being after the order of his Son, which order was from the foundation of the world, or in other words, being without beginning of days or end of years, being prepared from eternity to all eternity according to his foreknowledge of all things. I think this is significant to get one main point here, and that is that this is a high priesthood he's speaking of. And he goes on and tells us that that is the Melchizedek priesthood. This is the high priesthood he's talking about. Now, that isn't a presidency. That isn't a high priest, one high priest over the church with two counselors. Let's get this understood. Or one high priest over a church as such. This is speaking of a order of priesthood. And they call it an order, after the order of God. And it also says, after the order of the Son of God. So see what false teachings, how it brings confusion into it. We're talking about the Melchizedek priesthood because he goes over here in the 10th chapter and points it out. I'm going to read starting with the 7th verse. Yea, humble yourselves even as the people in the days of Melchizedek, who was also a high priest. Melchizedek was a high priest. Now, does that mean that he was presiding over that church as one individual? Well, the thing I would say, first of all, that he belonged to the order of the high priesthood. So the high priest and the high priesthood is not necessarily synonymous, if indeed he presided over a group of people, as would say a pastor of a church, then he would be considered a presiding elder or a high priest over that people. But he held the office, or he was a member or a part of the he was ordained as into the high priesthood. I'll get it said here in a minute. And it was this same Melchizedek to whom Abraham paid tithes, yea, even our father Abraham, paid tithes of 1/10 part of all that he possessed. Now these ordinances were given after this manner, that thereby the people might look forward on the Son of God, it being a type of his order, or being his order. And this, that they might look forward to him for a remission of their sins, that they might enter into the rest of the Lord. Now this Melchizedek was a king over the land of Salem, and his people had waxed strong in iniquity and abominations. Yea, they had all gone astray. They were full of all manner of wickedness. But Melchizedek, having exercised mighty faith and received the office of the high priesthood. Now, let's understand there's a difference here. He wasn't just a high priest. He was received the office of high priesthood according to the holy order of God, did preach repentance unto his people. Now behold, they did repent, and Melchizedek did establish peace in the land in his days. Therefore he was called the Prince of Peace, for he was the king of Salem, and did reign under his father. Now there were many before him, and also there were many afterwards. Now this is just kind of left out of the scriptures, but the Book of Mormon makes that plain. There were those who went before him, and there were those that came after him, after his time. But none were greater, therefore of him have they more particularly made mention. And so that's the reason why it's called the Melchizedek priesthood. It's actually the higher priesthood. And we have that today. So let's not react immediately and say, when somebody says high priest, oh no, there's not such a thing. There is the high priesthood. And if you want to call someone, refer to them as being high priest, well, that might be your likes or dislikes. It's not of any importance. Now I want to go to the Bible and read the two accounts. The one account here is found in Genesis. It's only three verses in the 14th chapter, verses 18 through 20. And this is all it says in the Old Testament. And Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought forth bread and wine, and he was a priest of the Most High God. And he blessed him and said, blessed be Abram of the Most High God, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be the Most High God, which hath delivered thine enemies into thy hand. And he gave him tithes of all, meaning that Abraham gave him tithes of all. Now I say I probably misspoke myself. I said this is the only account that we have in the Old Testament, and that isn't necessarily true. There are other references to this priesthood, I believe it's found in the Psalms in the Old Testament that I know of right off. Now in Hebrews, Paul speaks of this, and it's very similar to what is spoken of in the Book of Mormon. In the 7th chapter, beginning with the first verse, it says, for this Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest of the Most High God, who met Abraham returning from the slaughter of kings and blessed him, to whom also Abraham gave a 10th part of all, first being by interpretation, king of righteousness, and after that also king of Salem, which is king of peace. Without father, it's not speaking of Melchizedek as a person, it's speaking of that priesthood. Without father, without mother, without descent, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but made like unto the Son of God, abideth a priest continually. Now consider how great this man was, unto whom even the patriarch Abraham gave the tenth of the spoils. And verily they that are of the sons of Levi, who receive the office of the priesthood, have a commandment to take tithes of the people according to the law, that is, of their brethren, though they come out of the loins of Abraham. Now the peculiarity of this, and you may disagree, those of you who have been made a study of this. The peculiarity I find is that Paul is trying to draw a comparison between the two priesthoods. He's going back to Levi, the sons of Levi. And we know that Moses and Aaron were of the tribe of Levi. And they were of that, when they returned to the promised land, they were not given a section of land like the other tribes. But their inheritance was to be priests and ministers to the people. That was their inheritance. Now, the sons of Levi did receive from the people the tithes, as did Melchizedek. But what I feel, and you can read this on through, what I feel is that Paul is showing a comparison that the priesthood that was among the Levites was the Aaronic priesthood. That was the priesthood that Aaron was, was called to be, and it was named after him. Again, they use a man to distinguish a certain priesthood. It was the lesser priesthood. Now, I went back into the Old Testament, and I have looked up the words high priest, as many as I could find. There's very few references to it. And I find, peculiar to my thinking before, that the high priest were of the Aaronic priesthood. Now, here is a contradiction. Because you say, well, the high priest should be of the high priesthood. Well, it isn't. It's of the Aaronic priesthood. That said, it was very frustrating and confusing when I got into this. Well, Paul is showing here, as near as I can tell, if you read this chapter 7 on through, and I'm going to just hit high points on it, it appears to me that he is pointing out that, of course, he is trying to make a point as he goes on here, but he is pointing that the Levites exercise themselves in this duty to take tithes. And why? Because there wasn't a Melchizedek priesthood there, apparently. All they had was the lesser priesthood. Now, we'll have to consider what the high priest's duties were. If I can find my notes here. I know I'm taking a lot longer here than I want to, but I want to point out something that's pretty important. Just to make it brief, the duties of the high priest are not very clear in the Old Testament. But Paul, being a student of the scriptures, I can depend on him, I believe. And he says that they were the ones that made the sacrifice. And they were the ones that went into the, the Holy of Holies. They were the only ones allowed to go in there. And they were to make sacrifice for all the people. There had to be the shedding of blood. This was a type of the coming of Christ. Now, as we read on here, we find that there was a change. Well, I'll read here in the 7th chapter, starting with 11th verse. If therefore perfection were by the Levitical priesthood, for under it the people received the law, what further need was there that another priest should rise after the order of Melchizedek and not be called after the order of Aaron? You know, what was the need of it? Why should somebody else come along and fulfill that responsibility that was being taken care of by a lesser priesthood? Well, he goes on in the 12th verse. He says, for the priesthood being changed, there is made of necessity a change also in the law. Well, what is he talking about? What priesthood was changed? Here we have the Melchizedek priesthood that is from beginning of days to end of days. It is from eternity to all eternity. And the same is true of the Aaronic priesthood. What priesthood was changed? It was the high priest of the Aaronic priesthood. That particular office was changed. They were done away with. No longer needed. Why? Because Christ made this sacrifice once and for all. So, when you go back now and look at the Old Testament, that there was actually high priest existent back then, well, you say, well, that isn't... they were of the Aaronic priesthood, and they were done away with, or that priesthood, that office was done away with. We know the statement here that the Lord spoke of Christ as thou art the priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. That's said, I don't know how many times, in the writings of Paul here. That thou art a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. What made him have that right as having that priesthood? If I can find... the word here. It's also, there's another place that speaks of him as being an apostle and a high priest, which shows that he was of that higher priesthood, the Melchizedek priesthood. Of course, naturally he would be, because he is the Son of God and is after the order of the Son of God. That doesn't have to be proved. But it's not speaking of an elevated position as president over the church. Christ, there is no one to fill his place. This is the point that I'm taking. At any time, this that the high priest of the Aaronic priesthood that we're doing back in the Old Testament days was done away with. But it was a sacrifice for the people. Well, Christ made that sacrifice once and for all, so it done away with that office. And this is important for us to remember, that we don't become confused on this. Like I said, I could go into this in more detail if time would permit, and I hope that I'm not confusing you on it. Well, now that we say, well, okay, you've convinced me on the Bible, what about the Book of Mormon? There were high priests in there. And you just can't get around that. Well, and of course I read the scriptures talking about the high priest. The first high priest that I found was of King Noah's priests. There were several of them. They were supposed to be ministers of their people, presiding over their people. And they had gone into wickedness. Apparently, that was something that was a set order among the, a form of Nephite government, or whatever you want to call it. They were wicked priests, most of them. But Alma, recognizing what was wrong there. He was later ordained or set aside by through the Spirit of God as being the high priest over the church. He was, of course, the founder of the church. You find that on page 274, verse 17. His son, Alma, as you remember the story, rebelled against the church. And when he was knocked down and chained, he was became a very religious man, very faithful man. And he was given, his father conferred the office of high priest upon him. So we say, well, okay, now we got one high priest over the people, and then there was another high priest conferring the priesthood. We even got lineage, lineal priesthood here, which is some seek after. And it speaks of this priesthood as being the holy order of God. So we can't say, well, it's just an office as such. It speaks of the priesthood as being of the holy order of God. Here again, I believe that there's confusion. And I hope that I've unraveled it, but again, many people may disagree with me. But Ammon is going to mess up the lineal priesthood because he was a high priest over the land of Jershon. This is found on page 409, verses 1 and 20 of the 16th chapter of Alma. He was a priest over the people there, and he was of Mosiah's son. And I don't know that he was any relation to Alma at all. Gidona, another individual, was a high priest over the land of Gideon. And these were all of the same church. They were all closely connected, people were. And this is found on page 411, verses 23 and 27. Now Helaman, the son of Alma, was also a high priest. We're getting back to the lineal priesthood again. But this time it's a little bit different. This is found on page 468, verses 25, 26, 34, and also a verse on 73 in that same chapter. But it says Helaman and his brethren. I suppose that are his blood brothers, were high priests. We're going to speak of more than one there. Well, they might say, well, that they were the counselors. Whatever. But later on in the book of Helaman, page 551, verse 23, it speaks of the high priests and teachers. But like as in King Noah's time, the high priests become wicked. And just prior to the coming of Christ, which is found here in 3 Nephi, page 619, verses 25, 27, and 32, it speaks of the high priests and lawyers who were became angry at the prophets, at particularly Samuel the prophet, Samuel the Lamanite, who had prophesied to them. So likened to that, in the Bible, we find that the high priest there, in Christ's time, did not like the prophets, and they stoned them, or had them stoned. And when Christ came among them, they were responsible for his death, directly responsible. So we wonder about these high priests. My evaluation of the situation in the Book of Mormon, when it refers to a high priest, since there were more than one group of people, each group having a high priest, again, a presiding elder, a pastor, is what I consider them to be. Now, at one time, there was only one group of people. Alma was the high priest over. And we find in our own church history that we had a presiding elder, even though there was one individual, Granville Hedrick, that was ordained as the president of the church, as a prophet, seer, and revelator, translator, etc. That later on there were presiding elders, but the only church we had was right here in Independence, and it had one congregation. And come down to Brother Clarence Wheaton's day, and he was the presiding elder for a time. But he acted as a pastor over the church. Now, you know, it sounds like I'm trying to make excuses here, but it's not. I mean, you have to look at it from some consistency in the matter. These men, all having different groups of people, each were given a responsibility over the group of people. And in the absence of what the church had later, the absence of having apostles, they were taking that place. The book of Acts, we find that the high priests were responsible for contesting Peter and John's works, and that's in Acts 4 and 6, and that Paul, who formerly was called Saul, was commissioned by the high priest to go to Damascus and persecute the saints there, and he even had a letter to that effect that struck down. So the high priest played a very important part of this, but Paul was confronted with the high priest finally. We find this in Acts 23, 1 through 5. And he was kind of tricky, you know, Paul knew him pretty well. And when they proceeded to question him, he made the statement, or he made the reference to that he did not wish to be disobedient to the rulers of the people. And he said, "You high priests are rulers of the people." Now that's where the transgression had come into being. A high priest is not a ruler unless he's given supreme directional control. And we find that in our own day, and the devil just kind of follows that pattern right on down through the years. Well, I'm not going to go into the fact that Christ was trying to prove that Christ was the last. I don't like to use the term that Christ was the last high priest. I know some choose to use that. If you do so, well, that's up to you. But Christ's position done away with the high priests that were making sacrifice. What Christ did away with that. He made the one and only, the one true sacrifice that atoned for the sins of men. So I'll leave it at that, and I feel that clarifies it and puts it better. He was the mediator of a better covenant, it says. It was better than what they were doing back in Moses' time and on down. He was the mediator of the New Testament. There was a change, a new covenant, a new testament. And he was the, as in all cases before, there had to be the death of the testator, it tells us in Hebrews 9, verse 16. Now we know the scripture that says in 1 Corinthians 12th chapter, verses 27 through 31, it speaks of first apostles, secondarily prophets, and I know that you're well schooled with that. There were first apostles. There's no place, no mention of presidency in this. And it says, speaks secondarily of prophets. So if there were apostles in the church, there were prophets in the church. And we find that through the Acts of the Apostles through their writings that are contained in the New Testament, that various ones of the apostles were prophets and were classified as such, or we can identify prophecies there in their writings. They were prophets. There was not one prophet that was a prophet over all others. There was not one prophet, seer, and revelator set aside for the church. They each acted according to the gift that the Lord gave them. And this is important. In Ephesians 4:11-12, he says he gave some apostles and some prophets and so forth, and for the perfecting of the saints. There are different things there that the Lord has given, and I'm not going to go into the details of them. We find that in the New Testament, again, proof that when the church was called together, that there was apostles and elders that took care of the affairs. And there were some pretty serious problems that come up, yet there was no mention of one of the apostles being in charge and telling them, you will do thus and so. It was as a council effort, you might say, a combined effort to do this. And we know the number was 12. We just can't find 15. We cannot find 19 apostles, and we cannot find a council above that, those 12, in no place in the Bible or the Book of Mormon. One individual contested me with the thought that Peter was given the keys to the kingdom of heaven, therefore he had to be the president. You remember that incident? Christ wanted to know what they called if they knew who he was, so forth, and we'll go into detail. And it was a wonderful thing that Peter had the answer there. And Christ told him that blessed art thou, Simon Bar-Jonah, for flesh and blood did not reveal this to thee, but your Father who is in heaven. It was a very wonderful thing to say, and he went ahead to say, I give to you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. It wasn't but a short time after that. You just read down on the next page. That Christ turned to him and told him, get thee behind me, Satan. That's a terrible letdown. You were complimented here in one moment because you did something right, and the next moment here you were saying, no, they're not going to crucify you because I'm not going to let them do it. And he even drew the sword and clipped off one of the servants of the high priest's ear. And he was so determined that they were not going to crucify him. But I said, you didn't understand those things. Well, I can't get it to fit that Peter was a president of the church, because he was one of the 12, and he was named as one of the 12 apostles. And that's the big and the little of it. Well, if you want still a greater evidence, we feel that the Book of Mormon does not have any, not been tampered with by man. We have the vision of Nephi, which was pretty much the same, I guess, as the vision of his father. And if you will count it up, in this vision, the angel or the personage that was speaking to Nephi refers to the 12 apostles 9 times.